From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a former state GOP lawmaker who fought to ban same-sex marriage in 2004 now says that was wrong.
This was a very dehumanizing process we went through here. It was, to so many of us, myself included, just politics.
Plus, more objections to Detroit's bankruptcy exit plan.
The legal landmines are, frankly, starting to pile up right now.
We meet a musician using his talents to boost his hometown of Flint.
I found music and performance to be a really great, almost like organizing tool.
And long before the days of air conditioners and antihistamines, allergy sufferers found blessed relief from their sneezing in Sault Ste. Marie in the Ka-Choo Club. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. A former Republican state representative says he was on the wrong side of history when he opposed same-sex marriage during his time in Lansing 10 years ago. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, a former representative from Genoa Township talks about the gay marriage ban in Michigan and the future of the Republican Party. Then we talk with a talented Flint rapper about his music and how he uses it to raise the profile of the Flint community. That story later this hour. But first, yesterday was the deadline to file objections to the disclosure statement that spells out Detroit's plan to climb out of its bankruptcy hole. And yes, objections poured in, long lists of objections. Here to tell us who's on that list and why and what comes next is Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood. Now, Chad, just review for us again, what's in that disclosure statement?
Well, the disclosure statement's kind of the details, the nuts and bolts, the fine print. So to speak, of the plan of adjustment to cut Detroit's debts of $18 billion by at least half. And what it does is it's supposed to be the document that creditors can read and fully understand and grasp how they're going to be treated, specifically creditors who are facing cuts. And so it goes into long, lengthy details about how the city plans to redo its budgets, spend money in reinvestment in city services, blight removal, hiring more cops, getting more replacement of EMS vehicles and police squad cars, and some of the infamous leaky fire trucks. But at the same time, also gets into details about how much a retiree who votes for the plan can expect to get after the bankruptcy ends.
So it's basically kind of a roadmap.
It is, yeah, and it's really, I mean, there's a formal document called the Plan of Adjustment that is actually the formal document adopted by the Bankruptcy Court, but then there's the disclosure statement, and this is important because starting May 1st, the city will send out so-called solicitation packets to some 67,000 creditors who are going to be impaired or cut in the bankruptcy. And this will include like a CD-ROM. They're not going to send the whole 600-page document. And then that document is probably going to add a few pages before it's all said and done. But a retiree or a creditor or somebody will be able to put this in the computer and pull up this large, voluminous document and read through it and make their vote accordingly.
So let's, Chad, go down the list of kind of who met that Monday deadline to file their laundry list of objections and what their objections are about. And I guess why don't we start with the bond insurers and the bondholders?
Yeah, the bond insurers are companies that essentially, like as the description says, they've insured bonds for sewer, water, general obligation bonds, and they are objecting to a large number of issues related to the water department, to the emergency manager's proposal to try to spin off the water department into either a regional authority or to contract out operation of it to a private company that would in turn give the city some money for the right to run the department. And their objections really are about details. They want more details, and they're also just objecting to the scenarios that are laid out, because they're right now, what the city would like to do is have this regional water authority, but there's so much political impasse with Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson and Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle that the city is now trying looking at alternatives like contracting out to a private company. The problem that creditors are raising with that is that they can't go in and vote for something they don't know what the outcome is going to be on. So they're trying to say that this disclosure statement can't go out to creditors because if they vote to the sewer bondholders vote to approve the spinoff of the department and then the city turns around and keeps it in its possession or contracts or privatizes or sells the thing outright, that's a different scenario and a different set of circumstances. That's one of the biggest issues the bondholders raised in these filings last night.
And, of course, then, speaking of that, we have Macomb and Oakland counties making their debut into the bankruptcy court process and filing their objections to that plan to form a regional water authority.
They are, and also just they're raising a lot of other objections to how the city envisions paying off legacy costs associated to Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, which supplies water to 4 million customers in southeast Michigan. And that's going to be another sticky point because the suburban leaders are going to say, those are city retirees. We shouldn't have to pay for them. Mm. But the city and DWSD and the general retirement system will say, look, they work for everybody, really. They work for all ratepayers, supplying water or treating wastewater in Detroit. And so all ratepayers should have to shoulder the burden of those legacy costs.
Because they're drinking the water.
They're drinking the water, so they have to have to pay for it, and that's going to be still a very contentious issue. That the fact that you have Oakland and Macomb County now stepping in and objecting to a large portion of this plan puts a whole new wrinkle and dimension into this bankruptcy that we haven't seen yet.
And we've got, of course, the labor unions and the retirees, and now we're hearing retirees who put money in the general retirement system might face cuts in their retirement savings as well as cuts to their monthly pension checks. So
yeah. They've some retirees have paid into an annuity plan over time, but in the way that the plan was structured, they could get back more than the rate of return that was actually made on their investment. So it's like a defined contribution, like a 401k.
Yeah.
And say you pay in 10% and the 401k pays you 11%. I'm just using example numbers.
Sure.
The city is saying, no, that essentially that one extra percentage point was given to you at the detriment of other creditors or other retirees and a detriment of the entire system. And so the city is actually proposing to claw back that money and deduct that further from the already cut pension checks that they will. I mean, so under that scenario, if let's just say the plan goes through and the retirees accept the 26% cut in exchange for not making a play for Detroit's art,
right?
Then those retirees who also had this annuity and got overpaid according to the city would get even further cuts. There's other wrinkles in this. It's not as cut and dry as the emergency manager's numbers would portray them.
And so, what happens now? They've met the objections get filed. What's the next deadline?
The next deadline is for the city to respond, and the city will respond by next Monday, and then next Thursday, the 17th, there's going to be a hearing on this, and the city will have to make some changes between now and then. You will likely see another version or two of this plan get filed. That's why I said the 600 pages will probably grow. I mean, as some creditors said, the 600 pages kind of belies the dearth of information here, that they need more information. So that will likely be the next phase of this. At the same time, we've got a big ruling coming on Friday from Judge Stephen Rhodes in this bankruptcy over whether to settle this troubled pension debt, these so-called interest rate swaps that were tied to this $1.4 billion the city borrowed during the Kilpatrick administration. That ruling on Friday could be pretty pivotal in this entire bankruptcy. and what direction we're going to be headed.
You know, Chad, considering all these objections, and now we've got Macomb and Oakland counties involved with formal objections, are you hearing concern that this whole bankruptcy plan could unravel, could fall apart?
Well, there's always the concern, although the power is in the city's hands here. Municipal bankruptcy really empowers the debtor more than a corporate bankruptcy does. And so if, you know, the option, the nuclear, so-called nuclear option, is out there of what's called a cram down, that if the city can't get these creditors to agree to this, they could just simply, they have one creditor that will agree to it. It's the banks that hold those interest rate swaps. They've agreed to essentially vote for the plan. If they can get them to vote for the plan and they can get the judge to allow a cram down, you know, they could exit bankruptcy this summer if they wanted. But that's going to be a very, very controversial process. It's going to be fraught with lots of objections and legal landmines, and the legal landmines are frankly starting to pile up right now.
With time running out, knowing that Kevin Orr would likely be sent home in September.
Yeah, maybe. I don't always accept that there's an 18-month deadline because the emergency manager, his appointment is not limited to 18 months. It's just that the city council could try to vote to remove him, and the mayor would have to consent to that as well. At the same time, there's loopholes in the law that would allow the governor to appoint a new emergency manager or give him some kind of an extension before that, before the city council could act. So most people will agree that the deadline by September is really more of a political deadline focused around the elections in November.
Chad, live and good, Detroit News reporter, trying to sort out the ins and outs, and there are many of them, of the Detroit bankruptcy process. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We've been hearing from the experts that thanks to the great winter and our good friend the polar vortex, this is going to be quite a year for allergy sufferers. Well, perhaps it might be time to revive the Ka-Chew Club. Say what? The Ka-Chew Club, it was a very unique way to attract visitors to Sault Ste. Marie. It started in 1928 and welcomed allergy sufferers who turned up to breathe that clean, cool, pollen-free air that swept in off Lake Superior. Writer Deidre Stevens dug into the history of this Ka-Chew Club for Michigan History Magazine. Deidre, how and when did Sault Ste. Marie become this destination for hay fever sufferers?
Well, apparently it started earlier in the 1920s, but it was 1928 before a fellow down at the locks who was a hay fever sufferer himself, Lou Harris, noticed that certain people were turning up at the same time every year, about the middle of August, and he finally went down and engaged them in conversation, and sure enough, they said they came here because of the hay fever and had been for a while. Well, he got thinking about it and said, gee, if they're here, there's probably others, and put out the word and said, let's form a club. Let's find some things to do when it's too nasty to be down south, and we'll and give you some activities and keep you here for as long as it takes before it's safe to go back home again.
So Sault Ste. Marie's air really was that pure? It did come by its reputation, honestly?
Apparently so. There were scientists and things that checked the air here and said that there was less pollen here than there were other places. And as you say, it's probably that nice fresh air coming off the lake there that blows that pollen other places. It's not coming across all the fields of the Midwest and everything. So, you know.
So the Ka-Chew Club of the Hay Fever Association of America formed as an official club in August of 1928. I've got to wonder, was this, do you think, like an early version of a Pure Michigan ad? Can you hear Tim Allen saying, come to Sault Ste. Marie and leave your sneezes at home?
It could well be. You know, the Chamber of Commerce here quite quickly got involved in advertising it that way. They had brochures and everything they were sending out in the magazine and other places I've seen. Luckily, we have a copy of it that was preserved at the public library here. Positively no hay fever at the Sioux, the ad said. That's why it's this modern city. It is the hub of the Great Lakes. It's been selected as the permanent headquarters of the Hay Fever Association of America.
So, tell us how the Ka-Chew Club grew and evolved then in the following decades.
Oh, golly. Everybody went home after the first year and started talking it up and telling everybody how wonderful it was up here. And by the second year, they were pulling people from five states, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Maryland, and, of course, from Michigan here. And each year it sort of snowballed, and later on, a couple years, they were finally getting some public national attention. And they were on NBC, the radio station, and CBS, and all sorts of people got to find out. So by 1935, the numbers had swollen, if you'll excuse the expression, to 181 paying members from 14 different states, I think mostly around the Midwest. So things were really cooking by 10 years after the club first got started.
And I have to imagine local retailers and merchants and restaurateurs would probably be very happy to welcome the Couchouers to Sault Ste. Marie.
Oh, very much so. I think they asked them for a nominal charge to become members. They were associate members, not full members of the Couchou Club, and then they could have a little sign they could put in the window that said, you know, Couchou Club members, welcome here. And also sometimes the merchants had exhibits of things that were going on related to the Couchou Club, too, to create more interest, such as ragweed, so you'd know the enemy if you saw it.
Would they be there at, was it a particular couple of weeks, month? How long would people come, and when would they come?
Yeah, some would come earlier, some would come later. Most of them were here, and the official activities took place from about mid-August to about mid-September or the third week of September in general.
And you had to give the Couchouers something to do then while they were in Sault Ste. Marie. What kind of activities would be laid out for them?
Oh, very definitely. They had concerts and card parties, and they'd take trips on the boats around here, and I think the tour train that goes across the way here, the Agawa Canyon tour train, they'd often do that. Or they'd go down to Les Chenaux and do some things. There were some really nice hotels down in Cedarville in those days. They'd go down there and have dinner. But then they also did some other fun things, talent shows and things like that. And they had some very high-class entertainment who came here, surprisingly. Misha Mishakov, the concert master of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, was here. I guess he was a hay fever sufferer, too. And pianist Florence Reed, I'm not sure where she was from, but even some of our local people who had some recognition, I think certainly that helped them to get a little wider recognition to be performing at these functions.
Yeah, I found. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was going to say the city people got involved, too. In 1939, they put on a play the Couchou folks did called Demon Ragweed, and they had him tried for his sentences against humanity. And that was put on with a parade, and we had weekly concerts down here at our band shell, and that was right after the band concert, they put on this Demon Ragweed play for everybody, so everybody got involved.
Gotta love it. Gotta laugh at your allergies. And I found it very, very interesting, Deidre, that the group actually built up enough clout so in World War II they were able to lobby the government to let hay fever sufferers stockpile those gasoline ration cards so they could make it up north for the sake of their health.
I thought so, too. I don't know if they succeeded or not. I suspect some of them had to be fairly well off anyway, you know, to be able to come up here on a regular basis. But, of course, during the war, didn't matter how rich you were, I guess, if the gas wasn't available, it wasn't available. But it would be good to know, you know, that they were still able to come, because that's a medical issue, right?
There you go. Well, by the mid-60s, the Couchouers had dwindled to nearly nothing, and they decided to wrap it up, 1967? What did they blame for the reason for the dwindling ranks?
Well, they said that the people who were still coming, I think it was only five or six people, they couldn't get it, nine, I guess, came that year. And they blamed antihistamines, the availability of antihistamines like Claritin, I don't know if I should advertise, and air conditioning. People could stay right in their houses. They could deal with the symptoms of their illness, so they didn't have to leave home. And they said it was a shame. It was like losing members of the family, not being able to all get up together and come up here to the Sioux. But they could come anyway, I guess. But they just didn't have the Couchou Club as their excuse anymore.
But for those nearly 40 decades, people, or four decades, people really did get relief from their hay fever when they came to Sault Ste. Marie?
It sounds like it. And they even had some scientific evidence to back it up. And now that may still be the case. Back then they were saying there wasn't any ragweed to be seen. People were out hunting it and picking up a very little bit. But I've seen some ragweed in the summer myself now. I suspect it's wound its way in here. And I had read that it came in by way of the trains passing through. Some of it would blow off the cargo. And then in chicken feed, of all things, you know, a little odd piece of ragweed would come in on the chicken feed. So I suspect as far as it growing, it's still here. But maybe there'd still be some relief as far as the nice cool winds.
Well, I have to say, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a cuter name for any social club, the Cachou Club. And Deidre Stevens wrote all about the Cachou Club for a recent edition of Michigan History. Fun talking with you, Deidre, and I hope it's a fun ragweed-free season in Sault Ste. Marie.
Thank you. I hope it is, too, for everybody, whether they're in the Sioux or not.
Do not make the mistake of thinking that fresh new music, rap, electronic, and a whole lot more comes only out of Detroit. Listen to what's coming out of Flint.
Give me any test, I can make the grade. Check the interior, I'm better made. Used to be a boy, I'd rather be a mage. Possession is a ritual, the raven's at the cage.
Tunde Olaniran is a Flint artist, singer, songwriter, rapper, electropop, rock. Tunde is attracting lots of attention, including a glowing review in the New York Times for his new EP, Young Archetype. And it is a pleasure to welcome Tunde to the studio here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
You know, the New York Times made a really good point in its very glowing review about your EP. And it points out that you can rap in many distinct voices, but you have, and I agree, a beautiful R&B tenor and falsetto. And MTV called you a pop futurist. How did that strike you when you read that?
It's one of those things where you never expect to see your name on something that you look at all the time. You know, just being associated with MTV and having them recognize you in that way. It was a huge honor, to sound cliche. It was really a big honor to hear that.
What do you think a pop futurist is?
I think it's someone who takes elements that currently exist in your life, but you're also looking at how music and society can be different. And so you're almost making your music hoping for a different future that it would exist in. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, because you're trying to create something that you see in this vision.
Yeah, and as someone who's kind of been an activist in my community around a lot of different issues, I feel like the creative arts are always a way to envision something that maybe a lot of other people couldn't, and to maybe even help spark people's imagination. So I found music and performance to be a really great, almost like organizing tool for people.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about how you've been doing that in Flint, but I'm interested in the fact that you have really lived all over the world. You were born in Flint?
Yeah, I was born in Flint.
But you've lived in Nigeria, you've lived in Germany, in England, mm-hmm. and you're back in Flint. And why is that?
You know, I came back and went to high school in Flint, and I found the community that I was in to be so nurturing that I think it was responsible for a lot of my current work as an artist. Flint has such an amazingly supportive art community, and at one point I did showcases in Flint, and I would bring artists from Detroit and other cities, and they would be amazed at how into just enjoying art, you know, people in Flint are. And Flint is a small enough community that you get to know people, and you feel like wherever you are, you're kind of among friends, even if you don't specifically know that person. Flint just has a really interesting flavor to it that I don't know if a lot of people realize.
And so Flint has informed your music, but you've pulled in other influences from where you've
lived.
Yeah,
just being an outsider in a lot of situations, you know, being in Germany and being like someone touching your skin and not knowing what it's like to touch a black person's skin, you know, being in the situations where you do feel like you're on the margins a lot, I think has made me kind of more hyper aware of being in that space. And so songs like Brown Boy are kind of about that.
I'm every single thing you think of me. I'm a sinner, killer, drug dealer, refugee. So keep your jaw locked and I keep the peace. They act like they don't want I'm a man, they know me. So I'm a brown boy, I'm a brown boy. I'm a brown boy, I'm a brown boy. I'm a brown boy, I'm a brown boy.
I'm speaking with Tunde Olaniran, who is a Flint artist. He's a singer, he's a songwriter, and his new EP is called Young Archetype. And you've been working very hard using your music and artistry to really raise the profile of the Flint community. And a couple of months ago, you pulled together a showcase. Mm. You referred to this with other artists called Flint, a sci-fi love story. What was that about? And you really worked to pull the audience into it, didn't you?
Yeah, it came. It was inspired by a friend of mine, Adrian Marie Brown, who is creating an anthology called Octavia's Brood. It's inspired by the work of Octavia Butler. And it was really about, you know, people of color writing science fiction and how that's a political act, you know. And so I wanted to
Why?
I mean, I think that she brings the example of if you were a woman living as a slave in the United States in the 1800s, having a child was an act of science fiction because you can't possibly imagine a future, you know, for that child but you're still doing it. So you can't even imagine a better future, but you know that something can happen. And so the act of having and raising that child is in some way speculative or science fiction. And so when we're looking at, you know, groups like the Democracy Defense League in Flint, people resisting emergency management, people just working without having a clear promise of the outcome, I think is an act of science fiction and speculative fiction. So we wanted to bring that idea into this workshop, and it was so amazing. It was this intergenerational writing workshop, and we touched on so many different things. You know, we talked about – so many of the young people talked about losing someone, and I think that we don't recognize how – as a young person in high school today, you could have a friend and then they're gone, they're dead the next day, you know, living in places like Flint. So it was really this amazing experience. And a lot of the people in the room, we'd all collectively experienced loss of some artist all happening around the same time. So we had this really incredible emotional connection and almost a way to honor that loss, but also have some joy at the same time. It was just it was really cathartic. I'm sure people thought, "What is wrong?" Because I was like sweating and crying, and it was just really emotional. But it kind of reconfirmed that I'm in the right city. You know, that Flint is where I should be.
In fact, you held a writing workshop at the Flint Public Library earlier this year, and you asked people to answer the question, "What does Flint mean to you?" So, what does it mean to you?
Flint is home, first of all, but it's also the archetype. It's also the blueprint. You know, it was the city where the middle class was born, where the first community school system was created. You know, so many different things that Flint has served. And I think that looking forward, we need to see what Flint does next, because as places like Flint go, so do a lot of other places in the country. And that's kind of what made me write The Highway, because it was just this like – this feeling of we're facing so many different issues in this city that I'm seeing paralleled in other places like Detroit. And The Highway was just a way to really sing about loss in a way, but also have this like defiance too. So for me, Flint is just this place that everyone should really be looking at, because We're trying things there that you're going to be seeing happening all over the country and are happening now, but we'll see more of it, you know?
All the promises get made, I'm under the road they play. I hope this weather and you pay to let it take the highway. Yeah. They googling, oogling, ruins, brewing, and suing, illusions, tree farms, new cars, and Whole Foods, and sports bars, but nobody's pants will be sagging. Don't let nobody with hats, and don't drink the water we fracking. They paid, why not be happy?
What do you think it'll take to get people around Southeast Michigan or around Michigan to even kind of think about coming to Flint for music and creativity? Because you had some quote that I think was pretty on point about Flint's so easily overlooked.
Yeah. It's really not necessarily on everyone else. I think it's on people in Flint, which I'm trying to take some responsibility by inviting people. So at that show at the library, I had friends from D.C., from Philadelphia, from Detroit that came, So I think it's really on people in that city who I know are incredible and amazing to like reach out. And we're doing it, but we need to even be more intentional. So a lot of the work I do, I try to really intentionally, you know, at the show, there were Detroit and Flint artists working together to mm-hmm. create it. So that friendships kind of foster after it. So I think it's kind of on us in Flint to do it. It's not really everyone else's responsibility.
So you've got your Young Archetype EP out now. What other projects are you working on?
I'm working on a full length and, you know, doing tour dates. So the Tunde Olani Run website usually has all the shows updated if I'm doing my job right. But yeah, I'm trying to make sure those are updated. So people can always check that. I'm definitely playing, you know, all over the country and the state throughout the summer and fall, and hopefully the video for The Highway will be out soon. So yeah,
creativity keeps going.
Yeah, for sure.
Coming out of Flint.
Yep.
Tunde Olani Run, it was a pleasure to meet you. The name of the EP is Young Archetype. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is never too late to offer a public mea culpa for taking a political action you later believe was a serious mistake. And that's the idea behind a recent entry on the political blog Republicus. Former Republican State Representative Chris Ward wrote the post, declaring that he had been on the wrong side of history when he opposed same-sex marriage during his time in Lansing. Chris Ward joins us now. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to go back with you to 2004. You are the Republican representative for Genoa Township, and you joined with then State Rep Joe Hune, who was a Republican from Hamburg Township, to co-sponsor a House resolution that called for the constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. What was going on then that led you to put that together?
Well, you know, it was something that almost every Republican member of the House joined in. We sort of caught up in the moment, and a lot of pressure was put upon us. Looking back upon it, I think it was something that really was put upon us, I think, by the Bush campaign more than anything else. If you were to look at this historically, this is an issue that really came out of nowhere. You know, in the late 90s, in the early 2000s, this wasn't really an issue that people were talking about. Really, I think there was only one county in the whole country that had even issued a license to a same-sex couple.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, as the Bush campaign was looking at a tough reelection, and there were issues that people were talking about weren't very favorable, the economy, the war in Iraq, this was an issue that perhaps was an issue that they thought could be favorable, could bring out certain voters that they needed to bring out. And there were conversations being had in Washington and in Lansing about how do you get out evangelical voters? How do you get out especially Catholic voters who might be more likely to vote for George W. Bush? And then all of a sudden, this was moved to the front of the agenda. And even in the Republican caucus rooms, discussions were had about how do you get more vulnerable Democrats to take a tough vote. So we were swept up in the moment.
So it kind of sounds like it was, at the time, I mean, were you fully aware that this was a deliberate political tactic? It was just like throwing an issue, the issue of same-sex marriage, like throwing that like a bone for the public to chew on. Was there a sense, a moral sense that you were doing the right thing, or was there a sense of how much pain that this could very likely cause friends and colleagues and family members?
Well, as I said, you know, time gives you a lot more perspective. I was a brand-new freshman member, and maybe, again, term limits might be somewhat of a role to play here, but I don't want to let myself too much off the hook here. This was a very dehumanizing process we went through here. It was, to so many of us, myself included, just politics, and that's just not acceptable. This was people. This was our friends, our colleagues, people we worked with, valuable staff members, family members. And somehow we were able to detach ourselves from that and just treat it like politics, just another election, a short-term political game to be had to get through this next election, maybe win a couple of seats in the House, maybe get the president reelected.
Yeah, and as you point out in your blog posting on Republicus, and you write, oh, and the exit polls in Michigan showed that the Catholics showed up, voted against gay marriage, and then they voted for John Kerry.
Yeah, and then they voted for John Kerry. So the dividend certainly didn't pay out for this brilliant political strategy that was cooked up.
I'm speaking with former Republican State Representative Chris Ward, who today is a policy analyst with the Oakland County Board of Commissioners, who has written a blog posting on Republicus basically saying, I was on the wrong side of history when he opposed same-sex marriage during his time in Lansing. So what has led you to this process of here you are 10 years later and you've done a 180-degree change? Why?
Well, you know, I have watched my friends, and I've watched people in the Republican Party, especially. We've had so many really talented people. Ironically enough, we've sacrificed people in our party that could have been tremendous candidates, could have been tremendous assets to our party. We've sacrificed them because of their sexual orientation, where either they have left our party because of our terrible rhetoric and policies. They have suppressed it and turned themselves into something awful. Or, you know, they continue to suppress it and are living some sort of strange lifestyle because of that. Mm. All of this is just horribly unnatural and wrong. And we also have a problem as a Republican Party with a horribly inconsistent philosophy that I think is turning off an enormous amount of voters, especially young voters. We cannot at one time talk about freedom and liberty out of one side of our mouths and then have this as another part of our philosophy. It just is a horribly inconsistent message to be conveying to the voters. And I think it is showing itself increasingly election after election. Now, that's just the political end of this.
Yes.
Now, the human end of this, the cost that it has is enormous. And I think there is a point in time now for those of us who feel this way, a short window of redemption, I think, I hope, where now that the court has ruled, we're at a point in time where maybe we can help those who are waiting now, because I think the public opinion has changed tremendously on this. This is going to happen. It is just a matter of time. So now we're just making people wait. Mm. And it is a horribly mean-spirited thing to do to make people wait. I think almost everybody understands now that this is going to happen. So now we're just making people wait. And so maybe those of us who understand that are Republicans, maybe we can just be a little bit more courageous and step forward and help tip the balance here and help make this change happen now. So those people that are waiting, that love someone of the same sex, don't have to wait any longer. And we can make this difference in the 11th hour. And buy ourselves a little redemption for the harm that we've done and help heal some of the wounds that we created.
And since you have put this posting on Republicus and, you know, being on the wrong side of history and the big banner that says it's time, what are you hearing from your fellow Republicans?
Well, a surprising amount of people have been very supportive and agreeing. One of the things that supporters of the judge's ruling have asked me to do, they've asked me to find other former Republican legislators who agree to sign on to a letter or a press release and also onto an amicus brief to support the judge's ruling. So I've been contacting other legislators, and so far I've found 11 others, so 12 former Republican legislators who are willing to do so. And I'm continuing to call around, and some of them are pretty surprising to me, and hopefully there'll be a lot more by the time I'm done.
Would you have kind of a timetable for this, Chris?
No, I haven't gotten a deadline yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to shoot for the stars, you know.
Yeah.
And who knows?
I'm wondering what your feelings were, not really your intellectual thoughts, but your feelings as, first as you watched Judge Friedman's ruling come down, then you saw the one day of couples marrying, and then the door slams shut, and now Michigan's attorney general is fighting to overturn that ruling. What are your feelings?
Well, you know, I was for 4 years the deputy county clerk here in Oakland County, and so a big part of my job was the business of marriage. And so I was actually quite happy to see the people in the business of conducting the marriage and filing the licenses here. I was very happy to see those people working with the folks here who have long wanted to be married, even if it was just that short window, be able to do that. And one of the people that was able to get married was somebody I've known a long, long time, and that's probably the smartest man in the Michigan Republican Party, Greg McNeely. I've known him since I was a teenager. He's our best strategist. One of the most ironic things with Republicans in the state, our most brilliant strategist is somebody who loves a person of the same sex. And yet he has been quietly beaten up behind the scenes all these years. And what a wonderful thing for him that he's been able to enjoy this little window of opportunity to be with the person he loves.
Chris, when you look at conservatives in America and in Michigan today in 2014, you think of who you were in 2004. What do you see when you look at conservatives today?
Well, I see this as a turning point here. I see this as an opportunity, too. I see this as a chance for us to get our message and our beliefs corrected. I think we went off track in the 2000s. And I think this is for those people who believe in limited government and lower taxes. There is absolutely nothing inconsistent with that in staying out of the bedroom in people's personal lives. And if you're a person who loves somebody of the same sex, there's absolutely nothing inconsistent with believing in smaller government and lower taxes. And I know a lot of people who fit in that same category together, and they should not have to choose between one or the other. Unfortunately, the Republican Party has driven those people away in droves, and it will take a long time, a very long time, for the Republican Party to be able to attract people who love someone of the same sex again to their the Republican Party again. But we can begin to heal that now. But if we can get back on a consistent message again, we can start doing it now. And this is an opportunity to do so. Now, we've lost all but one popular vote election since 1988. The Republican Party suffers tremendously from a diversity deficit. There is absolutely no arguing that fact. If the Republican Party does not grow its footprint of voters, it may never win another presidential election.
Chris Ward is a policy analyst. He's with the Oakland County Board of Commissioners, a former Republican state representative. And we have put a link to his blog posting on Republicus on our website at MichiganRadio.org. Chris, pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, it was great talking with you as well. Thank you.
As Michigan's August 5th primary and the November election draw ever closer, there are some very tight races shaping up. The Cook Political Report says four congressional Republicans are in tight races. Representatives Dan Beneschek in the 1st, Tim Walberg in the 7th, Justin Amash in the 3rd, and Kerry Bentivoglio in the 11th districts, all in very competitive races. Add to that the race to fill Democrat Carl Levin's Senate seat and the race for Michigan's governor. All of these, according to Cook, are among the most competitive races in the nation. So who are the voters who could most influence the outcome of these races, depending upon whether they stay home or head to the polls? For the answer, we turn to Paige Gardner. She's president of the nonprofit and nonpartisan Voter Participation Center. Paige, you've done an analysis of what's called the RAE, the Rising American Electorate. What is that?
The Rising American Electorate is comprised of unmarried women, African-Americans, Latinos, and other people of color, as well as 18 to 29-year-olds. And the reason we call them the Rising American Electorate is because they are 54% of the voting eligible population, but they are not the majority of the electorate. So our job at the Voter Participation Center is to make sure that those people who can vote do vote.
So these REI voters, the unmarried women, the people of color, young voters aged 18 to 29, they really tended to sit out those 20-term midterm elections. Do we know why?
Well, as you know, there's a drop-off among all voters between presidential years and non-presidential years. The Rising American Electorate, though, does, as you mentioned, disproportionately drop off. Part of it is they're very mobile. That's one of the reasons, and they're stressed and stretched economically, particularly in this economy, and they are not, you know, news seekers. So candidates need to really speak to the lives and, you know, understand how these particularly unmarried women are living today, and they need to speak to the issues that will really go to their kitchen tables.
And we certainly know it was strong support from these very voters that helped reelect Barack Obama in 2012. And then we heard the GOP leadership talk about needing to reach out to these REI voters. Is that happening in any substantive way?
Well, the key to the Rising American Electorate really is unmarried women. They are the drivers of this because they're such a big component of it. And so the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic Party, they're trying to reach these women in a substantive way because the marriage gap does determine who is and who is not elected. For example, if unmarried women had voted like married women, mm-hmm. Romney would have, gotten 308 electoral votes, and he would be President Romney today. So they determine elections. Candidates need to really reach out to them and speak to them on issues like equal pay on Equal Pay Day, like a rise in the minimum wage, and like helping working mothers and stopping pregnancy discrimination, giving paid leave, and things like that.
Do you get a sense that these voters are not feeling engaged as we get into this upcoming election cycle?
We're just coming out with a survey that does show they are not engaged as other voters are now. They are not paying attention to it, and candidates are not really speaking to them about the issues that they care about. However, we have tested messages and we've looked at messages that, again, go to making sure women get equal pay, helping working mothers, helping working women by giving them a rise in the minimum wage, and protecting Medicare and Social Security. So when you talk about these issues, the motivation to turn out really goes up.
And so the wise candidate would pay attention to this.
Exactly.
Paige Gardner, president of the nonprofit and the Nonpartisan Voter Participation Center. Paige, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
And thank you very much for having me.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.